Hi everyone, Gutmayr, and I wanted to jump on the podcast before this episode to say that Mishpacha Magazine did an interview with me about the podcast and myself. So for those interested, if you haven't seen it, I'll put a link in the show's notes. People may be interested in finding out more about myself and the background, how the podcast started, and it's in the interview. I did a podcast episode about this a while back, an introductory episode a couple of years ago, but this is, you know, if you're interested in reading it, you can check it out. So I'll put a link to that as well. It's in the Mishpacha's Pesach edition if you have that, if you haven't seen it, and it may still be available to purchase in stores. I don't know. Now, because there may be new listeners for this, I wanted to say this for old listeners as well. I'm always available for guest suggestions, comments, feedback, questions, etc. You can email me, svarandcheddar@gmail.com. Or if you want to sponsor an episode, support the podcast, there's a link in the show's notes through PayPal, or for other ways, you can email me as well, svarandcheddar@gmail.com. Or again, the link is in the notes or the website, svarandcheddar.com. And as always, especially if you're a new listener, but even an old one, the same thing goes. You can subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. And on Apple, if you can rate the podcast, greatly appreciate it. It's just, you know, clicking the stars, and or if you're so interested, you can review it. And again, any comments, questions, feedback on anything. If you have any questions on the article and you want to ask me anything or feedback, email me, svarimchatter@gmail.com. Hi, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Svarim Chatter podcast. On this episode of the podcast, I'm going to be joined by Professor Rani Shah, who is the Edward Earl Sparks Professor of History at Penn State University. And we'll be discussing Trent, the murder ritual trial in Trent in 1475, Simon of Trent, rather famous or infamous incident of a ritual murder trial, otherwise known as a blood libel. So thank you, Professor Shah, for joining me.
My pleasure. Well, perhaps I should say a word as to how I got interested in this, because I'm not a specialist in Judaism, and nor am I a specialist in Jewish history. I really got into this through my interest in German literature and German culture. I mean, I think everybody knows about the atrocities of the Nazis. But I think what I was not prepared for was to find out what a long history of anti-Semitism had in Germany itself. So this was really a sort of accidental discovery when I was doing research in the 15th and the 16th centuries.
So let me actually pull back for a minute before we even get there. So if you don't mind telling listeners a little bit about yourself and your background, especially you just mentioned that you're not really an expert on Judaism. This is not exactly your general field of scholarship.
My general background is that, I grew up in Hong Kong, came from a Chinese tradition, but Hong Kong at the time of British rule. So I actually went to Europe to study at first before I came to America. So my interest has always been sort of cultural interactions, and particularly through religious exchanges. Now, I don't think there was a strong Jewish presence in Hong Kong when I was growing up, so I wasn't really quite aware of it. There was a Muslim center, and we certainly had different Christian and Buddhist faiths. But in general, that was something that I've always been very interested in.
So, research, and I don't think I mentioned that you wrote a book on this, Trent 1475 Stories of a Ritual Murder Trial. It's about going back 30 years or more that you wrote this book, but you did really write the book on this topic. So how did you become to research and write a book on this?
Well, I first wrote my dissertation on the city in Germany in the 16th century. And it was a city sort of famous for an Anabaptist sort of kind of eschatological millenarian uprising. And then when I read the records, I found that, well, when the Anabaptists were defeated and the bishop came back to the city, he allowed some Jewish families to move into the city. But 6 years later, when the city regained its civic liberties, one of the first things that the city councilors did was to revoke the license for the Jews and kick them out. So I just thought, wait a minute, that's kind of like an interesting detail. Why were these people so hostile to the Jews? Then I started trying to read about Jews in, you know, medieval Germany and in the 16th century. And then the next thing you know, you start reading Luther and what Luther had to say about the Jews, which is not something that, let's say, a lot of scholars who come from a Protestant background would be completely out front with you. I mean, they know about this, but it's not something they are proud of. And they don't, it's not something that when you study the Reformation, it's the one of the first thing you know.
So
one thing led to the other.
I want to ask you about Trento, I think, right? Where it is. You mentioned Germany. It's kind of this funny, it's all the way north Italy. So it's kind of Italy, Germany, it kind of changed hands. At the time, it was part of the Holy Roman Empire.
It was part of the Holy Roman Empire. As you know, the linguistic line between Italian and German is just a bit to the north of there. So today in Italy, you know, you would find the province of Alto Adige. And Alto Adige, it's basically German-speaking. They have a German-speaking minority there with German language rights. Although some of those people are irredentists, they want to be part of Austria. So that has a kind of complicated history. And in the 15th century, during the ritual murder trial, it belonged to the Holy Roman Empire. So it was under the rule of a prince bishop who was Austrian himself. The majority of the population was definitely not big. We don't have any census figures because we don't have any civic records from this period, was probably somewhere in the ballpark of 5,000. And if I would venture a guess, I would say 75 to 80% of the population were German speaking, including almost all of the Jews. They were Ashkenazim. Well, they were all Ashkenazim, but they were German speaking Ashkenazim, except for one woman who was basically, I think, Italian speaking, and her family had more Italian heritage.
So when you say 5,000, I mean, today in people's minds, that's not a lot, but it's 5,000. At the time, was that a village, a town?
It was a mid-sized town. I mean, I'm just guessing. It could be well less than 5,000. We just have absolutely no population figures from this period.
One more thing about the town, let's call it, of Trent, that you mentioned was under a bishop prince. If you could just explain like what that means, that's an important part of the story as well.
Well, a prince bishop is a particular institution in the Holy Roman Empire. Just as we play chess, we have the bishop here, who is a powerful piece. So bishops were political figures ever since the creation of the Holy Roman Empire with Charlemagne. They were important administrators. Some of them were rulers over territories. I mean, like the patron of Mozart was the prince bishop of Salzburg. He ruled over Salzburg as well as being a prince of the church, a high dignitary. You know, he owned land, he raised taxes, he had an army, he had a state. So that's what a prince bishop is.
Okay, so now we should discuss the story. I mean, unless you want to start with the Jewish community, but I think we should start with the story and we'll discuss the Jewish community of Trent at the time as we go through. So Simon of Trent, and listeners may have heard of it, it's kind of not the earliest, it's William of Norwich, there's earlier instances, but it's a pretty major, I guess, blood libel, famous blood libel. So let's talk about the story and who Simon was and what happens.
Well, these charges almost always happen over the conjunction between Passover and Easter. And the story happened when the servant in one of the Jewish households went down to the basement to get water. The basement also serves as the ritual bathing place. And it leads to canals outside in waterways, ditchways. And he found the corpse of a little boy. And he alerted his master and they were all stunned. And then they knew these things have happened in Jewish history, but they had no choice. So they went to report this to the local authorities and they came home. And later on, they were all arrested. When an accuser then went before the authorities and said, well, you know, he saw this boy being kidnapped or entered the house of the Jews. So that's how the tragic story first began.
And we can talk about the Yeshiva University manuscript that you used for this book, but you really give it over in the book. For those interested, I'll put a link in the show's notes for the book later, you know, in the notes of the podcast, but you really lay out very movingly how they come home and they find the corpse, and there's the small community, and there's just confusion, hysteria. They're just, what do they do? And they know what's going to happen. They almost know what's going to happen, but they feel they have no choice, as you say, and they report it. Some want to run away. They don't run away. We can talk about it. So it gets reported. They're inevitably arrested. You know, what happens?
Once they were arrested, there is already, if you will, a strong prejudice against the Jews and the presumption of guilt. The law of the Holy Roman Empire allowed for the application of judicial torture. There are strict regulations as to how much you can apply. You can never supposedly maim the person or hurt them that they cannot recover, and there has to be a limited time period. But it was quite clear from some of the sessions that, as you know today, with police abuse, police are not supposed to hit people, but they do, that clearly there was a very liberal application of judicial torture. Strongly linked to, I think, the conviction on the part of the authorities that these Jews are guilty. We just have to get a confession out of them. And the reason why the presumption of guilt was not just a generally prevailing anti-Semitic trope among the Christians, but in that region of northern Italy and Austria and southern Germany, there were at least two cases of blood libel within a generation. One of them happened just a few years before that in a small town near Freiburg. Freiburg is today in southern Germany between the French-Swiss border. And that resulted in a ritual murder trial, a blood libel, the blood libel of Emmingen. And several Jews were executed. But it was not allowed to pick up political steam because the emperor said, you know, just stop this already. And the other one happened in Austria in a village called Rinn. And there was a boy who was supposedly murdered, and the accusation was raised against the Jews, but it never came to a trial. But the suspicion always lingered. So I think the Prince Bishop and a lot of the people there, they just kind of thought, well, this is part of the pattern. In fact, the Prince Bishop sent officials to Emmingen near Freiburg to get a copy of the court testimony. And so you can see how the whole chain of events, it's a suspicion that this is, you know, a pattern of crime that is, you know, much deeper than anybody can imagine. They were determined to get to the bottom of this.
Now, as you mentioned, there was judicial torture. So first of all, they just were trying to extract a confession. And once they confess under torture, well, that's it. That wasn't considered, you know, coercive. That's factual. But also, you described very much the torture in the book. They strung them up on a rope. They would put hot eggs under their armpits. I think if you want to describe a little bit, it's just very graphic. It's a really terrible situation.
I think the main thing is to string people up, which is called a strapata. And then, you know, interrogation under this. And so long hours of this will, you know, dislocate your joints. And that is the main thing. And then they put sulfur under the nose. But that is the main thing. In some ways, the kind of judicial torture applied here in the case of Trent would be similar to witchcraft trials, at around the same period and particularly later. The same judicial methods were applied. So really, except with very few exceptions, the application of judicial torture was universally accepted in the European system of jurisprudence.
I think that's an important thing to point out, because as I mentioned, the title of the book, as you call it, is Stories of a Ritual Murder Trial. It's called a trial. So they mm-hmm. view this as a trial, even though in our eyes, we view this as a sham. How is this a real trial, right?
I think we have been aware in the past few years about not only the possibility of the miscarriage of justice, but also how prevalent it could be, and that it has been. Just in, let's see, in U.S. history, for example, trials against American African Americans, trials about, you know, sexual misconduct and so on and so forth. We are now much more aware of how the judicial system and how the police apparatus have worked, sometimes intentionally and sometimes without particular ill intent and with full conviction they're doing the right thing in obtaining the conviction, incarceration, sometimes the execution of completely innocent people. And the blood libel trials is similar. So if I may add something, when I wrote the book, it was particularly difficult during the process of reading the trial records and coming to terms with this. And one obvious reflex is to speak up for the victims, for the innocent, to restore the voice. But then I thought, what is really more important is to show the systemic reasons why such a miscarriage was possible in the first place. And for that, I need to keep my emotions in track, try not to become an advocate for the Jewish accused, but rather present everything for the reader. And I think people can see for themselves the human tragedy here. And yet, to the extent possible, to understand the, if you will, the logic of this historical tragedy. And that was a very difficult balancing act.
Yeah, I can imagine. I mean, I read the book a couple of weeks ago, and even just reading it, as you say, it's very balanced, just trying to portray through the manuscript, through the sources of what happened. I mean, it really, one reading the book, even just as you wrote it, comes across, and as you say, as balanced as it is, you still come across feeling for the victims, and you're just like, this is horrible, you know, because that's just reading the sources. It's just a terrible situation. So let's talk about the accusation. I mean, you mentioned blood libel, ritual murder trial. What exactly was the accusation here? What do those kind of two terms mean?
So the 15th century, the late 15th century was also really the first time outside of Spain. In Spain, it had a longer tradition with the Sephardim because of the Sephardim's interactions with both the Muslim community and the Christian community. But for the Christians who were in interaction with the Ashkenazim, they just didn't know very much about the religious rituals of the Jews or the customs because, first of all, most people did not read the Bible. Most people were illiterate, or even when they read the Bible or knew something about the Bible, it would be the Christian testaments, or they would know it from pictorial evidence. So I think most people were completely ignorant, let's say the Pasha, what exactly happens, you know, the maledictions against the Egyptians, the blessing of the bread, and so on and so forth. But in the late 15th century, you have a number of Christian scholars who began to study Hebrew. And then the prejudices against the Jews then latch on to fragments of this knowledge. All right. There is the maledictions against the Egyptians, the killing, the slaying of the firstborn by the Lord passing over the land because the Pharaoh refused to let his chosen people go. And so I think fragments of this kind of story is then synthesized with the idea of sacrifice, which is essentially in Christianity, you know, the sacrifice of Christ, metaphorically represented as the Lamb of God. You slaughter a lamb, or you slaughter a young boy. And this is, of course, the sacrifice of Isaac, the supposed sacrifice of Isaac. So I think a lot of these religious ideas kind of flow together, not in a systematic way, but in a kind of popular synthesis, amalgamation of different ideas, putting this together. Now, the really difficult question to answer is, well, what happened to these child victims? I mean, sometimes, you know, there were nobodies, but sometimes authorities did find the corpse of a young child, usually a boy. So we have then another whole historical phenomenon is, you know, children get murdered. By whom? And then I began to speculate, but I realized in doing research for this book, there is no way to make an answer for this. It's not, we have pedophiles today. We have crimes against children. Children do get murdered. But I think what was really horrific for me was to find one documentary testimony, and this is the case for Germany, for the case of Trent, that some Christian was trying to sell his own child to the Jews, thinking the Jews would, you know, could draw some blood, maybe not kill him, and he could make some money. And that was absolutely horrific. The Jews were horrified, you know, to whom they would make this offer. So here is, again, where you have a broth of both fragments of imagination, religious ideas, as well as real events, real crimes, or purported crimes being committed. And it is just so impossible to disentangle this, but you can understand how it is.
So we won't get through all the exact facts, and as you do go through in the book, all the different Jewish, you know, Jews living there, and each one, you know, you describe in detail as each one is tortured and what they say and kind of what happens. So if you want to just in brief to just pick some parts, how they take them all, they torture them. We'll go back to that. They torture them. They pull out confessions, various really gruesome kind of confessions, I guess, of what they purportedly did to Simon, as well, kind of they force these tortured confessions out of them. And then they sentence them to death after that.
Well, I think all of the men were put under torture to different degrees. I really don't particularly want to go back. Some had more sessions. And I think the authorities quite early on identified sort of what they would be thinking of as major culprits or accessories to murder. And so they would treat them differently. And I think, but what was shocking to me was that they would also put under some of the women under torture. Now, in hindsight, one should not be surprised, because in the witchcraft trials, about 80% of those interrogated were women, and a lot of them were subjected to horrendous torture. A few of the arrested died of illness or the effects of torture, but clearly there were, you know, I write about this one figure, who confessed very quickly because he didn't want to be tortured anymore. He began to collaborate, turned witness for the prosecution. But then later, you know, he turned again, and then he was executed. I would rather not go too much into the detail, because it's that part of the book that I don't need to revisit, is the details of the torture.
Absolutely. I would say that we can leave that. And again, I'll put a link in the show's notes for those interested in reading it. You know, I told you before we started recording that I read this a couple of weeks ago on a Shabbos, and I found it fascinating, but in a terrible way. I mean, it's just really depressing. It's horrific, really, reading those depictions of torture. It's really no other way to put it. And as you know, you can imagine as you read the depiction and then you hear them confessing, and you kind of almost hear them while you're reading it. And it's like, they just want it to stop. It's just...
It's like this recent movie on Emmett Till. My wife went to see it and she said, this is important. I said, I know it's important, but I can't. I just can't. So I refused to see the movie. She went there with our daughter. The two of them cried their eyes out. But it was important to see that. It's just, I just couldn't take it. I just couldn't. Yeah. So I didn't go. I chickened out.
I hear you. And that's why I'll leave that for those interested in reading the exact specifics. I just want to make clear the gruesome specifics are in the book. But let's talk about something important. The church's reaction is, I think, very important. So we mentioned the prince bishop, but then what about the, and he's, you know, all pro, you know, that the Jews did this blood libel and he wants to kill them, etc. But what about the church, the pope, and just the general church's reaction to this story?
As far as the papacy was concerned, the Jewish people had a well-defined role. They were reprobates who refused to convert to Christianity. But the theology was that they would be kept as a reprobate until the end of time, when perhaps they would convert. That's the testimony to this. And I think the church, at least at the highest level theologically, never gave up the attempt to convert Jews. There were various attempts. But the Catholic Church does not recognize coercive conversion. You cannot forcibly baptize people. That's not a valid baptism. Secondly, the Jews were under the protection of the Pope. The largest Jewish community in the Italian peninsula was the one in Rome. They pay an extra tax, a protection tax really, to the Pope, and the Pope protects them. And from the 13th century onwards, it was a specific prohibition against the blood libel trial, saying that there is no factual basis that the Jews practice this kind of crime against Jewish children. So when this happened, the Rome sent a commissioner, another bishop, and this is De Giudici, whom I talk about in the book, who then went to Trent and basically got a hostile reception and almost no cooperation from his counterpart, the Prince Bishop.
So I guess what happens at the end? Let's just jump there for now. The men are killed. What happens to the woman, the children, and then just in general to the Jewish communities after the aftermath of the trial?
The women were tortured because they were tortured at a later stage. And I think they might not have been put under torture if this commissioner was not sent from Rome. Then the Prince Bishop was under much greater pressure to justify his actions, to actually prove that he handled the whole judicial process correctly. And that's why it was necessary for him to torture the women to obtain also the confession, and most of all, the conversion. Then, you know, just to say, hey, I have results. These Jews are now Christians. Now, it was particularly crucial for to convert the women because the Pope's commissioner was trying to contact the Jewish women in order to hear their side of the story, but he was prevented from talking to them. And the Jewish convert, Israel, who accepted baptism for a while in order to escape torture, he was the go-between between the two. Before he himself was found out, and then, you know, he renounced his conversion to Christianity, and then he was executed. But the bishop never got to talk to the women. He was denied access to talk to them. He went back, obviously, to Rome to file the report. We don't have his original report. But such is, I think, the politics between church authorities and the Holy Roman Empire that the Pope really couldn't do anything about this. Because the patron of the Prince Bishop in Trent was the Holy Roman Empire, was in the Habsburgs. So he basically just said, okay, you know, you handle things correctly, but absolutely you can't, nobody can do anything else. By this time, of course, the Prince Bishop who sponsored this whole trial managed to really whip up a great deal of passion about Simon of Trent. That's why this particular blood libel became historically the most notorious one over time, because he put in a major propaganda effort in terms of sponsoring publications, you know, spreading the word around.
If he was already doing this the whole time, as you lay out in the book, they took Simon, they left, you know, they found the corpse after a while, and it smelled horrible, and it was sitting there in the church, they just left it there. And I think even when the Pope's bishop that he sent, the emissary, comes, and he was just like, oh, it's terrible. He couldn't even be near the body. And this is what they were just, and he was, no, they're like, what do you mean? He's doing miracles, the body. And they were trying already. The propaganda machine was in full swing. And we can talk about the cult of Simon of Trent shortly. So what kind of, as you say, this is like from the most, you know, the most notorious blood libels. I mean, what kind of an impact does this have afterwards throughout the centuries?
Well, for one thing, the small Jewish community was wiped out in Trent. We have absolutely no documentary evidence of what happened to the Jewish women and the children. They eventually managed to somehow get back to the larger Jewish community in Italy. Did they manage to get back to the faith? We don't know. We have no idea as to the faith afterwards. What became notorious, of course, was that this was also the time when the printing press in Gutenberg and all of this was in full swing. And the printing press, in some of his earlier works, really highlighted the trial in Trent. And so it was really through this print culture that it had an impact in the 16th century and the 17th century. As I have mentioned, there was one case in Austria, in Rind, this village, a boy called Andreas, and never came to the blood murder trial. But after Trent, locals kind of reopened the whole thing. Now, by that time, there were no Jews for them to persecute. But what happened was that by the 17th century, they managed to get a local cult out of this boy and basically declare him to be a Christian martyr saint who was killed by the Jews. And it remained a local cult, not officially approved by the Vatican, but it was not abolished until the 1970s. And when it was abolished, the local Catholics staged a protest against the bishop. I mean, I was sent stories from the local newspaper, and this is quite stunning. So the Simon of Trent became, if you will, the archetype of what a blood libel should be. That is, it was always a boy, and it's always a Christian boy. And the reason why he is killed is not because of pedophilia or because Jews hate Christians. It was because it is like an enactment of the crucifixion of Christ, specifically like the Christ trial. So there is an emerging of the idea of the crucifixion, which in Christian culture in the 15th century became much more intensified, like the cult of Christ and the crucifix. If you have any kind of interest in Christian art, you would know that by the 15th century, 16th century, the crucifixion became such a prominent motif in Christian art, and especially really gruesome representation. The most famous one being the one by Martin Grunewald, which is today in a museum in Colmar, with a Christ figure that is, it's just a real human in suffering.
So it wasn't necessarily that they were killing the child to use the blood for matzah. That's not what it was.
That was the accusation, of course. That was the accusation, that it was absolutely crucial for Jewish rituals. But that began to be disproved, even by the Christians themselves, because as they began to study Christian text, they said there's nothing, in the Haggadah about this. I mean, they never sprinkle human blood. They don't use human blood. I mean, it's abhorrent to them. And even the most infamous Jewish convert to Christianity in the 16th century, Pfefferkorn said, no, Jews don't use Christian blood for this. They're bad enough if you think of it, but they don't use this stuff. So that became less important over time. It was still very important in Trent itself. And then over time, and then what is interesting, of course, is that by the 19th century and the 20th century, it's in anti-Semitic imagination, it's like the Jew as a child predator. And you have that very much in the Nazi kind of German anti-Semitism, And then the victim can be, female too. They would be interested, younger girls. So this is how the floating anti-Semitic racist ideas can become secularized and yet survive. It's like how, you know, COVID bacteria can mutate and become a new form of COVID, even though you find some kind of cure for it. It's a disease. It's a germ. The germ is really these ideas of prejudice and racial and religious prejudice. And of course, the great irony of history is how the Nazis look at the Jews themselves as carrier of pestilence.
Yeah, like this, like the way a virus mutates, right? So one other thing about Simon and the cult of Simon, as you say, it was abolished in the 20th century, but I think there's like a postscript to this recently, right? Fairly recently, in 2021, they returned his remains to Trent. There was something I saw that something recently happened.
I haven't seen the latest news about this now.
Yeah, I think I don't know. Okay, listeners could look at it. I think in like 2021, they returned the remains to Trent. Something is still going on with this. But so I do just want to ask you though, lastly, about this manuscript. You used mainly this Yeshiva University manuscript. Do we know who wrote the manuscript? If you could just talk a little bit briefly about the manuscript.
The manuscript was at the coat of arms of the Duke of Wittenberg. So it might have been commissioned by the Duke of Wittenberg. It was in German, unlike the other manuscripts, which were all in Latin. We know the interrogation was carried out in German. So the German manuscript might have kept more of the authenticity of the original interrogation. And then the manuscript passed from different collectors over time. The Latin manuscripts have always been either in Trent or in Rome, and they have been edited and published.
We don't know who wrote this manuscript, though, right?
We don't know who wrote the manuscript. We don't have an author.
And as for how accurate the manuscript is in the depiction of the events?
I think it is a text that needs to be disassembled. That is, when there is an interrogation, the description of the torture, how the Jews react, the emotions, then one can probably say, well, it was most likely taken from the actual verbatim, the trial records, some a scribe who was there taking notes. Then there are other long passages in which the scribe or the manuscript describes how they torture Simon and how they use his blood for the celebration of Passover. And that obviously was based on probably some false confession by the Jews, but fragments which will work up to a much more coherent, cohesive, and longer story by a scribe. So the actual composition of the text, I think, is the complicated one, in which there are particular parts which are much more trustworthy than other parts which are not. And it was my role as the interpreter to disentangle this and reconstruct what was, if you will, the original setting, the conversations, to the extent possible.
Okay, which you did in the book. And as I said, I'll link to the book in the show's notes, about 170 plus pages, but that's with the notes and appendices. So if you just read the actual story, so to speak, it's 135 pages. It flows very nicely. Again, it's just gruesome, really terrible story. And as you really lay out and depict the entire thing. But if anyone is interested in reading it, it's, as you say, it's important to, I think I read it. It's important to read while it's not a happy read. Far from it. It's a pretty depressing read. But I'll link it in the show's notes if anyone is interested in getting the book and reading it. And thank you, Professor Shah, for joining me.
Thank you for inviting me. It was a pleasure talking to you, Nachi.